Coming up today, we're going to be giving you a smorgasbord of highlights from the gaming event of the year, E3. We'll also talk about Eugene the chatbot, who may or may not have passed the Turing test, and the pendant that lets you panic dial your way out of a bad date. We'll also be hearing about Katie's trip to an activist meetup in the Ukraine, and find out about the war between London's black cabs and taxi app Uber. All that and more coming up. This is the Wired.co.uk podcast, your weekly guide to the important and the interesting, from science and tech to Chinese cybercrime and ugly wearables. I'm your host, Olivia Solon. I'm the deputy editor of Wired.co.uk.
I'm Leanne Clark.
And I'm Katie Collins.
And we also have
Chris Higgins.
Chris is our online assistant, and he is joining us today to give us a fantastic rundown of the highlights from E3, which he's been following particularly closely. And we do have a load of content on our website about all the latest launches from PS4, Xbox One, and the indie games. So do check out our topic hub. Just obviously search for E3 on wired.co.uk. And we've also had a load of feedback this week. Quite a few people weren't too happy about our irreverent coverage of WWDC, and we'll be reading quite a lot of that out in the feedback loop, which is at the end of the second section. But let's just start with the news. So, Chris, welcome to the podcast.
Hello.
I thought it'd be really useful. We obviously have a lot of stories on the website that people can read, but I wanted to get your opinion on some of the highlights from E3, and we wanted to see some of the major kind of AAA type highlights, but then also identify some of the indie games that you think have sort of really stood out for you, because I know that's your heartland, isn't it?
That's it, that's where I came from. That's what I do. This year's actually been really exciting, because last year was a little bit of a mess. There wasn't really a lot of cohesion between what the companies wanted us to see that they were going to do in the future and what was actually coming out. So yeah. This year we've got this really nice mix of really big, heavy-hitting blockbusters and a lot of really nice indies as well. So I'll just run through a few of the through the bigger ones first, I think.
Okay. So if I have never heard of E3, I've been living on the moon, and I want to know the highlights, the big name highlights from this year. What would yours be?
Probably for me, I'm a little bit of a nostalgic geek. So I would say that Zelda for the Wii U coming out is probably going to be my number one spot for E3 this year.
Yeah, that's quite interesting, isn't it? Because I wouldn't have suspected it would be a Nintendo game necessarily.
No, but exactly. They haven't been doing very well. So it was a little bit of a surprise that it came out and everyone was instantly excited about it.
But we only got a real little glimmer of it, didn't we?
Yeah, it was just a very short, even just a screen, just showing the world that you can go into. But it was the way that it was showing off was the big draw to it. So what we're looking at is probably going to be an open world Zelda game, similar to Skyrim, the Elder Scrolls series. It's even being called the Zelda Scrolls because they haven't actually given anyone a name for it yet. So it's going to allow people to come at any area in the game from any direction that they want. And that was something that they were really keen to put across.
Okay, cool. So what would be your second highlight be?
Second up, I would probably say was Scalebound, and this is another very quick glimmer of something on the horizon, and it's something coming on Xbox One exclusive, which is another interesting thing. I never thought that the Xbox One would actually gain any great exclusives. I'm not choosing sides here or anything, it's just they weren't doing very well.
No, we've had you on the podcast before where you were talking about, well, the connectless Xbox One that happened to come in at a price exactly the same as the PS4.
Yeah,
and I think there was some question as to why they picked that price point, but anyway, so Scalebound coming to the Xbox One, and what talk to us a little bit about it.
Well, it's coming from a studio called Platinum Games, who are quite well known for making really fast-paced action games which are really fun to play. And what we got to look at was a guy going through the forest a little bit scared, and then he turns around and there's a large monster there, and one of the monsters that he's fighting turns out to be an ally rather than a foe, and it seems that you are, as the name suggests, bound to a dragon, and it fights with you in battle against huge monsters. I mean, right at the end of the trailer there was they did that classic thing of, oh, you're fighting a big monster. Oh, no, wait, there's a bigger monster that eats the big monster. And
Oh, right. Is it kind of Shadow of Colossus style big monsters? Or
it did seem like that sort of scale. It also seems like there could possibly be a co-op mode. There were a lot of dragon riders coming in at the end to aid you in the battle against the larger monster. And it seemed like they could have been friends either in-game or online, possibly, as we're going on.
So big, badass dragons fighting. So what can go wrong with that?
Exactly.
What else did you want to highlight before we get onto the indies?
Probably the last of the big AAA ones that I want to bring out is everything from last year's E3. it might seem like a bit of a strange one, but next gen isn't quite able to stand up on its own two feet yet.
Yeah.
So it's being propped up a little bit by the ports from the end of last generation. So we've got Last of Us being remastered for PS4, GTA 5 coming out on next gen systems, and strangely enough, all of the Halo games.
Mm. Is that to compensate for the fact that the latest Halo game has been quite significantly delayed?
I think I would say that, but what they seem to have done here is that they've got a fully remastered set of the Halo games. Mm. So everything, even the cutscenes, have been redone to be a lot more polished and, you know, have that next-gen sheen to it. So you'll be able to play Halo 1 again against kids who weren't even born when it came out. That would be great.
You don't sound that excited about any of those announcements.
I'm quite excited about Last of Us, actually. I think it was a great game, and I'd like to play through it again, and this just gives me an excuse, really.
Okay, so now let's talk about the indies. This is, you know, what you really love, and you've been following them really closely and have a great story where you've picked out, I think, your 15 favourite indies from E3 so far, at least so far this week. Mm-hmm. But perhaps you could highlight a few of them.
Yep, sure. One of the first ones that I saw that really took me aback was a game called Abzu. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. I think it comes from a different dialect. But that's a really interesting underwater game, which comes from a couple of guys who worked on another indie game called Journey.
Oh, I remember Journey. That was really beautiful.
It was a lovely game. So part of the beauty that was in Journey should be able to come across, because they've got the former art director, Matt Narva, and the composer from Journey, Austin Wintory.
I'd love to see how that translates to an underwater world, actually. Mm.
It really does look quite interesting. A lot of ambience, and there's a sense of mystery, because, you know, we haven't visited the bottom of the sea. We don't know what's down there.
No, so. Don't like swimming over the sea when it's too deep and you can't see what's underneath it. Okay, so what else should we be looking out for?
Should definitely be keeping an eye on No Man's Sky. No Man's Sky is a space sim, and it seems like if they get it right, this could be the space sim that everyone's been waiting for. It's all about exploring an entire galaxy full of procedurally generated worlds,
okay.
Which have all this different vegetation, animals, environments that you can explore and really get into. But it's hosted in a persistent world where everyone can visit the same planets. And if you're the first person to visit a planet, then you metaphorically place a flag on that, and it comes up with who first visited the planet whenever anyone else gets there. So,
and getting a persistent world like this has been a big challenge for a lot of games companies.
Mm.
It's like a kind of Minecraft meets EVE Online.
Yeah, that's actually a very good way of putting it together. Yeah, and this holy grail of getting a persistent online world together is going to be particularly impressive if they pull it off, because it's being made by this tiny team in Guildford called Hello Games.
Mm.
So if they manage to do everything that the rest of the world's failed to do so far, then it'll be amazing.
Okay, and then what's your final recommendation?
My final recommendation is another game which really heavily puts its focus on exploration, and that is Night in the Woods. And that was unveiled at E3 as coming out on PS4. It was a Kickstarter thing for the PC.
Mm.
And it's a sort of coming-of-age tale about adolescent misanthropy.
Okay.
Which is all the more interesting because it's played out by this little cast of animals. And
this sounds amazing.
It's great. It's really, really great. So this gang of animals is hanging around in their old mining town, and they're really struggling to get to grips with how to deal with the changes going on in their lives and the town around them. So it's got something for everyone there, really. There's animals, there's deep soul-searching emotions, there's everything.
There's an old mining town.
Old mining town.
That's what we're all looking
and
for.
Exploration.
So if you're to pick your favourite thing out of all the things that we've seen coming out of E3, what would your one top tip?
No Man's Sky.
No Man's Sky.
100%.
Okay, well, we'd love to hear about your favourite games or developments from E3. Please do contact us on podcast@wired.co.uk. Do you agree with Chris? Do you disagree? Have you got other games you want to recommend to our audience? Just let us know. So when we think about government-sponsored hacking, I tend to think of it as something massively sophisticated, highly secretive, you know, lots of amazing tools. But it seems though this week, a bit of cybercrime from a Chinese hacker has been given away by sloppy use of social media.
Yeah, this is a little bit awkward. I feel quite sorry for this guy called Chen Ping, if that is his real name, who basically is just an overenthusiastic worker.
Well, where is he working?
Well, Olivia, he's allegedly working at Unit 61398 of the People's Liberation Army in China, which is basically a unit of the Chinese military with a focus on space, aerospace and communications tech, and also apparently industrial espionage.
Oh.
I know. Ooh.
So how did this all come to light?
Well, a cybersecurity firm in the US called CrowdStrike released this report into the unit and all its kind of investigative work around malware they were spreading. It had already released this information to its clients, but actually it kind of sounds like they were a bit irked by China's response to the US Justice Department indicting 5 members of the Chinese military for espionage. They wanted to release this report and say, you know, no matter what China is saying, I mean, China came out kind of quite annoyed, basically saying NSA, you know, massive hypocrites.
Yeah.
They spy on us all.
WTF.
Exactly.
NSA.
Which I kind of agree with. It's a bit awkward. Yeah. But they wanted to come out and say, this is not 5 people. This is an operation. And it goes much further than this. And it has industrial espionage at its heart, undermining, you know, patents that US companies work very hard for and all kinds of intellectual property.
Okay. So we have this mass espionage supposedly taking place by, you know, being undertaken by China and spying on US companies. But it all came apart because of one man.
Yeah. He so does not want to be known for this going down in history. I hope it's all wrong because I feel awful for him otherwise. Yes, Chen Ping, they came across, who identified himself on his personal blog as a soldier. Fine. He also put up pictures of his office. Fine.
Well, what is it like putting up picture of MI5 in your office?
Pretty much, I think. He didn't like explicitly say where he worked, but he said, this is my office. He talked about his training that he underwent. Now, CrowdStrike was kind of on the case, used image processing to identify immediately that this was the military building in Shanghai, where this military unit is based. Okay. So that's all fine. He also had a standard issue officer's hat from the PLA hanging in the background of one of his photos.
Schoolboy.
Yeah. I know. I know. I can't believe they didn't have this talk with him before he started blogging. Anyway, CrowdStrike CTO Dimitri tells me this actually happens a lot, like a surprising amount, because the first reaction from a lot of people is, come on, this is a joke. Like, no one could be this stupid.
Yeah, it seems like it's almost been set up to justify US intelligence services.
Exactly. There's something fishy here. But he reckons this actually happens an awful lot. For instance, soldiers in Afghanistan will post information about night raids on Facebook, kind of so their families know what's going on in their lives. And they're not thinking about the consequences. But one killer thing he did, which is just the icing on the cake, I thought. So the way the operation worked, it's been going on for 7 years, and the unit was using applications like Adobe Reader, Microsoft Office, to deploy malware via these emails they sent out in a very targeted manner. Now, they were tracing this and found out that one of the domains that was used for the malware call out was registered with a military officer's address.
Mm.
I know.
I mean, that's double schoolboy.
That is really, it's quite embarrassing. He apparently went back and changed it, but of course, that doesn't matter. You're going to find it anyway. So, I mean, I think this is a interesting one. Obviously, there's been so much about this in the past couple of years, and now the US State Department is finally indicting people over it very publicly. And China's been pretty irked by it. And I put this question to the team CrowdStrike. I said, you know, come on, doesn't the NSA do this? Like, do they really not? Don't you find this stuff, you know, from in the US? And they were like, well, we've not come across any US intelligence services doing this type of thing, but, you know, we would publicize it if it did come out.
I wonder what that means exactly, because I mean, we know that they've been involved in economic espionage and that kind of thing.
Well, this is the thing, they are absolutely adamant, these guys, that the US government does not and will not be involved in industrial espionage, full stop. They said, yes, maybe.
Who are they working for?
Well, for national security purposes, for policy making decisions, they said. You know, I mean, we know that they watched Argentina's oil companies. I'm pretty sure they watched
Brazil. Yeah, there was a big Brazilian oil company.
The CrowdStrike's argument is this is all for national security purposes. It sounds like they're drinking NSA's been serving. But I don't know. Maybe that's just because I'm not American, or maybe that's because I'm a real cynic. I don't know.
But what it does show, and it's often the case, is that the people, not the technology, can be the weakest link. And invariably, in any security system, whenever there's a vulnerability, it's the person who left the laptop on the train, or the person who put the password, didn't change the admin password, or the person who got convinced over the phone that someone was actually the Microsoft
technical support. Or it's just an NSA contractor who got fed up.
Yep.
Ooh. Exactly. Well, this is what I was saying. Like, the NSA, there has to be people within there that are having conversations with people in industry.
Oh, yeah. Like, massively,
that's going to happen. People are going to talk to their mates. There's so many lobbying groups constantly, you know, egging people in Washington. I'd be amazed if it didn't happen.
There are thousands of people that work for the NSA, and, you know, many of whom are linked to, like, outside companies, like Edward Snowden, and even worked for the NSA. He worked for, like, a company.
Exactly. Yeah. How do you control subcontractors to that degree? And I know maybe this is a bit naive, but I kind of, China, you think, is quite a controlled state, and you would, in terms of civil liberties and things, I kind of would have thought they would be really, really, really on it in terms of things like this and training people and letting things out.
If you've heard anything from Chen Ping, do let us know he's okay. Tell us on podcast@wired.co.uk. No, seriously, I do actually genuinely hope he's okay.
Yeah, me too. It's not his fault.
Now, the third piece of news we're going to talk about this week is the Turing test and whether or not a chatbot called Eugene passed it. Katie.
That's right. So I think it was at the weekend, the news kind of came out that a computer had managed to fool some humans into thinking he was a 13-year-old boy called Eugene Goostman. This was a competition that happened in London, which was occurring 50 years after Alan Turing passed away. So as such, Eugene's creators claimed that he has passed the Turing test. Now, this was the question that was asked by Alan Turing about as to whether machines were able to think.
Well, it was more as to whether machines can fool other people into thinking that they can think.
And basically, we've nailed AI when it happens, when a machine can pass the Turing test.
That is actually a massive kind of worms you just opened there. Because
That's the idea behind it. I'm not saying that because I'm not sure.
It's not, because actually it's quite easy to fool people into thinking that they're not talking to a machine when they are. But by the by.
Yeah, but I mean, that is kind of an important part of it, because this isn't the first instance when somebody has claimed that they've managed to create a computer that can pass the Turing test. It's happened before, and there have been times where, you know, computers have been able to fool people for like 10 minutes or whatever, and then it's kind of fallen flat. So apparently Eugene's creators claim that this is different because in this event it involved more simultaneous comparison tests than had been done before. It was independently verified, so I think a lot of the time when people have claimed their computers are able to do this, it isn't in fact kind of completely objective. And crucially, it involved unrestricted conversation. So this is what his creators, his Russian creators, have been saying. So as it turns out, though, Eugene only managed to trick the judges about 30% of the time, which is equivalent to about an F minus if you were to give him those kind of school grades. So for many artificial intelligence experts, this is actually not very exciting at all, the fact that he could score 30% on the test. And Eugene, an earlier version of Eugene is available online for anyone to interact with on the Princeton University website, I think. And our colleagues in the US actually tried to talk to Eugene and see what kind of conversation they could have with him. And I'm just going to read out a little snippet of the conversation. It went like this. Wired, where are you from? Eugene, a big Ukrainian city called Odessa on the shores of the Black Sea. Wired, oh, I'm from Ukraine. Have you been there? Eugene, Ukraine, I've never there, but I do suspect that these crappy robots from Great Robots Cabal will try to defeat this nice place too.
Wowza.
So as you can see, it really quickly goes way off target.
Yeah, and it kind of moves beyond just a 13-year-old with bad English to just complete gobbledygook.
An insane robot.
So the idea is that this 30%, which some people believe is the kind of the threshold that you need to reach in order to pass the Turing test, was set by something that Alan Turing wrote in his paper where he first described the test in 1950. And he said, I believe that in about 50 years' time, it will be possible to program computers to make them play the imitation game so well that an average interrogator will not have more than a 70% chance of making the right identification after 5 minutes of questioning. So this is an interpretation of something that Alan Turing said, but it's not actually necessarily, depending on how you read it, passing the Turing test, you know, this kind of 30% threshold.
Yeah, it's kind of we've made this test after posthumously Turing, but it's just been called the Turing test. Well, it's certainly something that people have been really interested in this week, whether or not Eugene did pass the Turing test, which it doesn't even make sense as a question, perhaps. What we do know is that now a lot of more people are interested in AI and the ability of chatbots to fool humans into thinking that they're intelligent.
And also what they're capable of potentially doing on the internet. So
It's a bit weird that they went for a 13-year-old boy.
Having a foreign individual for whom English wasn't their first language and who was a young child. So you could make excuses for their naive,
poor language.
Well, you can go and chat to Eugene, though, can't you? It's still hosted online on the Princeton website, so look it up. It's an older version, though, so we don't know how much it was improved upon before this test. But the other interesting thing about these tests is that people who tend to judge them are very familiar with AIs often, and they know the questions that tend to trip them up. And actually, if most of us were having a conversation in the way that we have those chats with kind of mobile operators online instead of making a call, which are those in themselves are often operated by chatbots, that if we don't know we're meant to be being tricked by something, we perhaps don't ask the difficult questions. The final piece of news is just a quick one about a somewhat strange piece of wearable tech.
Yes, Olivia. If you've ever wanted a fat silver pendant that's also an instant SOS beacon, you're in luck.
Phew.
I know. It's what you've always wanted. A Singapore-based guardian angel has answered your prayers, but perhaps not in the way you think. Because for some reason, rather than turning this piece of not particularly attractive hardware into a serious tool that could help people, they've decided to go the quirky inadverted commas route and make it a handy little piece of hardware to get you out of bad dates.
So instead of having a human interaction and saying this date's not going well, I think we should call an end to it, you can press a button on a piece of jewellery.
Yeah.
And then what happens?
No one wants to have that chat, let's face it. Well, then you will get a fake call on your mobile. You could just get your friend to like call you halfway through the date,
which loads of people do,
or they do in movies anyway. And
it's a solution to a problem that doesn't really exist. It's a tech solution to the problem.
Well, I mean, a problem does exist.
Yeah, but it's not having the guts to tell another human being that you don't want.
Come
to
Come on, Liv. Have you ever done that before? Halfway through a first date.
Okay, but I just don't think you need to spend $160 on a pendant to get
$120, but I agree 100%. It could have another capability, though. And this is, I mean, I'm a bit confused about how they're pitching it, because they're mixing two vastly different things. One's just a silly thing to get out bad dates. The other one is rape, which is, you know, I don't know why they've put this together. So the creators believe it's got the potential to be used here. You hold the button that you press to send a message to your the message to your phone to call you. If you hold it down for a longer period, a text will be sent to a chosen number that you've approved with the GPS location data of the necklace. And again, I mean, in an emergency situation, you probably want the authorities or someone on the case, but I guess it would be far too risky. I mean, it would be a disaster if they hooked this up to automatically call the police. Mm. There'd be loads of false call outs. But it's kind of, we've seen a trend for different tech for protecting women. It happened a lot in India last year after the very high profile gang rape. I think we covered an app where it taught women self-defense, and there are panic buttons that were being installed in public transport depots and things of that nature, which are, you know, quite helpful. So I don't know, I think it would be good to have something of that nature. But this doesn't seem to be it.
And it's also really ugly, let's not forget. It's a massive, unattractive pendant with a button on the middle of it. It's, if you went on a date with someone wearing it, you'd suddenly feel like your chances weren't...
they would leave.
You'd probably
and then they'd every be, now well, they'd and be then like, you either think I'm going to be a bad date or a rapist. like that, I mean, if that's not insulting to somebody you're going on a date with, I don't know what is.
Yes. Maybe it's a conversation starter.
So, by the way, you're not, are you? Because I'm wearing this necklace, so don't even think about
I've got
it.
A speedy line straight to my mate.
I get a rape alarm pretty much every Easter from my mum. Actually,
whoa.
Easter and Christmas. One year I got two. I got a lint chocolate bunny and a rape alarm for Easter. And I've never taken it out with me. I keep on forgetting. And I once mistakenly set it off. And it's the kind of thing that, you know, yes, if you're wearing this necklace at the time when you're attacked, and I'm not trying to trivialise it, but the practicalities are innumerable. You know, the idea that you'd have to be wearing this specific necklace on the day that you might get attacked, probably by someone you know, you know, possibly when you're not wearing all your jewellery. I don't know. It's just...
No, exactly. But get a rape alarm.
Get a rape alarm. Yeah, but
it's cheaper and you'll probably take it with you more than you would wear this.
Does she ever get you mace?
No, but I could do with some mace.
I think I'd like that, actually.
There's a look of mischief in your eyes.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of how I could use it.
I always worry about my physical capabilities. Unless I have, you know, I can't carry around my baseball bat, which is what I keep under my bed for intruders.
You've got keys.
Yeah, I know. I always do that. You hold them out. That is never going to do anything. Unless you've learned how to stab a human heart with a pair of keys. You
which
know.
We all have.
Then it's no
good. Did
they
not teach you that at school?
I bet you... Skies and Spooks could do that.
So I'd be interested to hear what you think. Are you a guy who, what would you think if you went on a date with a woman who was wearing a necklace that doubled as a rape alarm? And women out there, what do you think? I mean, would you wear this sort of thing? Are there other techniques that you would use, tech techniques, that do you make people do a fake call halfway through your date? Please tell us on podcast@wired.co.uk. But that's all the news we have for this week. But still to come, we're going to be talking about Katie's extraordinary trip to the Ukraine, where she got to hang out in the former president's palace. And then we'll discuss the legal wranglings that are taking place between London's black cabs and the startup taxi app Uber.
Do you want a free audiobook? You probably do, since you're listening to our podcast. Audible.co.uk is offering every listener of the Wired.co.uk podcast any book from its catalogue of 80,000, including the latest science, technology and business releases from best-selling authors, just for trying out its service. A one-month trial of Audible.co.uk costs nothing, and whatever book you choose to download is yours to keep, even if you cancel your account. Head to audible.co.uk/wired, where you can sign up in a few seconds to download any book you want. You'll be supporting Nate, Olivia, Liat and the rest of the Wired.co.uk podcast team. And you get a free book in return. Sign up easily now at audible.co.uk/wired. Thanks for supporting the show. That's audible.co.uk/wired.
Welcome back. Now, the first segment for this week's podcast is going to be Oh No, They Didn't. The reason I picked this segment title is because I think it's pretty extraordinary that a bunch of activists took over the palace of the former Ukrainian president. So for that reason, I'm going to say it's Oh No, They Didn't.
I think that's very apt, actually, Liv. So I was at this festival at the weekend in Ukraine, and it was a remarkable event, really. It was organised by this organisation from Serbia called the Share Foundation, and they generally tend to run conferences about digital activism. And this conference in particular was to celebrate Journalists' Day in Ukraine. Now, Journalists' Day in Ukraine was very different this year than it has been in the sort of three previous years, in that this year they didn't do what they usually do, which was arrive outside the president's residence, this gorgeous estate on the banks of the river just outside Kiev, and protest about the censorship and lack of freedom of speech. Rather than do that, they actually were inside the president's residence, enjoying themselves, talking about how they could improve their journalism, celebrating a little bit, considering they've had some rather amazing successes after Yanukovych, who was the former president of Ukraine, fled earlier this year in February.
So he got ousted. There was a lot of civil unrest in Ukraine, lots of protests about corruption, and he is no longer in power.
No. And so the actual story of what happened when he fled is really, again, quite remarkable. The activists and journalists in Ukraine sort of arrived at the residence, and when they got there, they discovered that there was all this sort of paper and all these documents floating on the water and had been kind of thrown in the lake before he ran away.
That's such a lazy way of disposing of your secret
and it
files.
Didn't work very well either. Fortunately, I think they did try to burn some as well.
Yeah, that would be better.
Yeah. So they got in a team of divers, journalists, activists, and they also kind of put out this call on Facebook. There was this huge kind of social media campaign that was really successful, and they got loads of local people down, and they were just there kind of trying to rescue all these documents. So they had the divers went into the lakes, and then they had to dry them all out individually, and there were also documents that they hadn't managed to try and destroy. And altogether they kind of, at the end of this, I think they spent a week there doing this and I think they had 25,000 documents at the end, which they then scanned and digitized and put on this website, which they've called Yanukovych Leaks. And the whole thing is kind of really, it's really sort of changed journalism in the country and what people have been able to do. And what they've done is they've created this kind of archive for journalists and for prosecutors to kind of go through, and also, you know, anyone else that wants to, because they want it to be really open. You know, a lot of these secrets that have been hidden, in which I'll come to in a minute, have been, you know, really kind of kept under wraps, and they think that it's about time, you know, it's the right time for people in Ukraine to be able to see what's been going on and essentially how their money's being spent.
So what did they discover in these WikiLeaks style documents?
Yeah, so I mean, the first thing that they discovered, which was something that they kind of knew anyway, but they found some evidence that activists and journalists that had been kind of targeted and sort of beaten up or attacked, they found evidence that these were kind of planned by the Yanukovych and kind of his cronies,
okay,
as it were. So that was kind of the first thing that they found. But I think the really big thing that's come out of it is they found just so many documents about how this huge estate in Ukraine, which Yanukovych took over a few years ago, claimed as his private estate, has been run for the past few years. So I think it's important to remember that I think 35% of the population of Ukraine live under the poverty line. And it's generally not a terribly rich country. And the amount of money and the kind of the sort of obscene levels of luxury that the president was living in, they found kind of proof of, you know, checks for $12 million, handwritten notes for all this kind of, for these kind of duck houses and things to treat his fish, his carp and his, you know.
That's a lot like our MPs.
And they also found kind of evidence that Yanukovych was very much, he kind of gave the impression of being this incredibly busy, incredibly, you know, proficient politician, you know, always tirelessly working for his people. And they found the notebook of his personal bodyguard, which is probably the best discovery of them all. And it kind of outlined the kind of the things that he would do throughout his day. So up until 2 p.m., he wouldn't really do anything. He'd kind of sleep and, you know, you know, probably so have nice breakfast, that kind of thing. And then he'd have like things scheduled in, like a massage, cosmetic treatments. And that, I mean, that was the other thing. So actually, I spent the whole of the festival within the private estate, the compound, but I actually went into this, into the kind of compound within a compound that he lived in. And there's this, just this massive sprawling complex of leisure facilities. I mean, the kind of thing that you would expect would be a kind of a health club or a spa for hundreds and hundreds of members just for him. And, you know, he had a hyperbaric chamber in there. He had all sorts of, you know, tanning machines, massage chairs. He had this kind of salt room with all these kind of salt crystals all over the ceiling and stuff, I think, which was supposed to be do something for your skin. I've got no idea. Anyway, so he spent a lot of his time kind of just
swanning around.
Yeah.
And with swans.
With swans, black and white swans, and all of his many, many ducks. He has a real thing for birds. So he had a big aviary full of peacocks and an ostrich farm as well. I mean, the kind of the extravagance is kind of mind blowing. And there are loads of pictures as well on the website if you actually want to go and see, you know, what his lifestyle looked like. But overall, you know, the atmosphere when the journalists and the activists all kind of came together was, I mean, first of all, amazement that this had actually happened, because, you know, it's one of those things that a few months ago they could only have sort of dreamed of.
Yeah.
And secondly, a sort of a sharing of ideas about, you know, how to expose corruption best, sort of best practice for how to kind of work online in order to create movements to help people, to help whistleblowers, to protect yourself as a journalist, both legally and also, you know, to protect yourself against hackers and that kind of thing.
Well, you've written a few stories about this. It sounds like it was a completely extraordinary conference. I guess it's kind of weird to even call it a conference.
But
if you do want to read more about it, Katie's got a couple of stories up on wired.co.uk, so just search for, I suppose, Ukraine would probably be the easiest search term. The second discussion topic this week is going to be order. And that's because we're talking partly about legal wranglings and partly about just general unhappiness. Now, this is a story about London cabbies who are today, which is Wednesday, the 11th of June, when we're recording, today protesting against Uber, the taxi app, in London. Now, thousands of black cabs, the official sort of iconic London cabs, have been driving very, very slowly in the city centre with the explicit aim of causing gridlock. Now, they're protesting this app called Uber, which many of you will already know. I say it's a kind of little startup. Actually, it's just been valued at $17 billion after receiving another round of investment. So it's not really the case that it's a kind of David versus Goliath. But the taxis have been planning this protest for a while. The action was actually initiated by the Licensed Taxi Drivers Association, and it relates to members of this association not being happy about Uber operating in a city in a way that they believe is unregulated. Now, this has kind of happened in a number of cities where Uber has launched, quite a few in the US, I think in France and Germany as well. But when I spoke to the LTDA, they had a number of specific grievances with Uber. They said that Uber was calculating fares through apps on mobile phones and argued that this should count as meters, and minicabs in London aren't supposed to have meters according to TfL rules. And so the point they're trying to make was that Uber is operating in an unregulated fashion. Now, TfL, which is the kind of regulator for these things, has actually issued a statement saying that smartphone apps don't count officially as meters, but it's actually now asked the High Court to make a final decision just to keep everyone happy.
They are nothing like meters.
They are.
They don't
really
tick up.
Well, either way, it's this kind of weird semantic wrangling. And if maybe if they are even meters, perhaps the regulation needs to be changed as opposed to kind of having this argument about it. But anyway, the second area of complaint is around interpretation of the rules again, really. And this is about minicab licensing, which actually requires the receiver of the booking to have a license. Now, the black cabs argue that individual drivers receive bookings and that Uber's just this kind of interface in between that's acting more like PayPal. And if this were the case, the individual drivers would need licenses and not just Uber. But Uber obviously disagrees and says that it, as the entity Uber, even though it doesn't have, you know, booking offices where they pick up phones to book cabs, says it has an operator's license, and so they don't need to have all the individual drivers who can just sign up to the app to have license. Despite all these specific references to Uber, the LTDA does kind of try to insist that the strike's not about Uber. They say it's about TfL not making Uber comply with the rules. And I spoke to Steve McNamara, who's the spokesman for the LTDA, and he said, we have to jump through a lot of hoops, and so do minicabs. And he said that he hoped, you know, that Uber should have to do it too, and said that, you know, Uber just swept on in with their snazzy American litigators and managed to kind of bypass all the regulations that they have to go through. So in some respects, you know, I have some sympathy. That was until they caused gridlock on the roads, thus proving incredibly unpopular in London today. And while this is all happening, Uber itself scored an absolute coup, in my opinion, a PR coup, while they were planning this strike, Uber managed to sign up some black cab taxi drivers to use the app to, you know, allow for bookings to be taken through the Uber app. And this was announced just at the time where the black cabs were congregating in Westminster, you know, beeping their horns and causing absolute mayhem.
Did they say how many, though? Could have been like three.
I don't think they've said how many, but what they have said is that now Uber, when you, because normally it's only kind of minicabs that you book, now you can, through the app, choose to book a black cab as well. And so it shows that they've got the support of some black cab drivers, and those are the ones who've obviously taken the knowledge, which means they don't need to use GPS to know where they're going. They just know the streets of London through and through, which is an awesome skill to have. And this is obviously gaining a huge amount of positive attention. And I think it's just, it does feel very much like the establishment being concerned about a disrupting influence invading their space.
It absolutely does. But to a certain degree, you can understand, like, when it comes to licenses, that's a very definitive thing, like Uber saying we've got the license, anyone can sign up. But I mean, from a safety perspective, they have something of an argument that, you know, any old person can just sign up, and they don't have to make sure that they meet a lot of requirements.
They all have checks. We know they can drive. We know they're not criminals.
Although I was in one
those
the other
kind
day,
of checks.
It was pretty terrifying journey. Yeah. But the thing is, Uber is a lot cheaper. But I also love black cabs. You know, these are iconic vehicles. They're really spacious. They always know where they're going, and you always get a lovely chat. And there's always going to be a place for those cabs. I think it's just about having a bit more choice.
Uber argues as well that rather than taking customers away from black cabs, what this is actually doing is opening up the option to use taxi-like services to more people that wouldn't usually use them, which, you know, is a fair point, actually.
Yeah, because of course.
It's not necessarily, it's probably the case, especially considering that London's transport system is already overcrowded. It's actually just providing another cheaper option for people.
What do you think of this squabble? Is it just a case of, you know, the establishment being mean to an invading new plucky upstart? Or do you think that Uber's managed to kind of wheedle its way into a system where, and it's not a fair playing field? Do tell us on podcast@wired.co.uk. Now, the final part of this podcast is the feedback loop. This week, I want to highlight a few complaints we've actually had from people who didn't like how mean we were about the humour at Apple's conference WWDC in last week's episode. So in last week's episode, we outlined some of the biggest Apple launches from the event, but we did another section in which we sort of took the piss out of some of the execs. We particularly focused on Craig Federighi's terrible jokes, and we commented on the slightly snarky anti-Android tone that we felt permeated the event. Well, some people didn't like it. Now, I know whenever we talk about Apple, we do tend to get complaints. Either we're being fanboys, and which is what Android fans always tell us, or we're being mean to Apple. And, you know, I don't feel massively sorry for Apple. It's one of the world's most successful companies. But I want to read some of the complaints we had out. So Alison Sheridan, who's a long-time listener, said, "You spent over 50% of the airtime talking about every joke told during the show and complaining about Craig's hair. Humour is a matter of opinion. Some liked the jokes, some didn't. There were some truly outstanding announcements put out by Apple, some of which bring it on a par with Android, to be sure. But to have the focus be on the jokes or Craig's hair didn't meet the standards I've come to expect from this podcast."
I would say, Alison, to be fair, we covered the event pretty diligently, I'd say. And, you know, as did the rest of the world. And it's okay to have something different sometimes.
It is. And I'm sure hopefully Alison will continue to listen and will perhaps keep it in mind that, you know, some people might not like our humour quite so much.
Sorry, Alison. Kerry Mitchell, a fan from Mexico, said, "Many people in the US rather preferred this new lighter and funnier Apple. Maybe their jokes were not funny to you guys across the pond due to the famous differences between American and British sense of humour. Personally, I think Apple has changed and I like this not so serious version. I also think that we Android fans should not take Apple's jabs at us too seriously. It's what Apple does, and the fact that Android is a topic for conversation in the Apple realm goes to show how serious they take Android now. It's all fair game."
I would agree, it is all fair game. I mean, I go to my fair share of Apple at conferences and Android launches, and they're all as bad as each other, to be honest. Just, I mean, they all have their own, like, they will have their own sort of unique style of cringiness. But
horses for courses.
Jim Hunkins didn't like it either. Considering that it was for a room of Apple developers, many of whom are loyal and dependent on Apple products for their living, they obviously were enjoying the humour. It was all done in fun. Not to mention, I seem to recall Samsung doing this with TV ads, which made fun of Apple users, not Apple itself. I don't recall you getting up in arms about those.
To pick up on that, like, Jim, with the Samsung TV ads, I think that's a very good point. Like, we didn't even talk about the Samsung TV ads. And that's kind of the issue here, is yes, we perhaps did go on about the humour a bit too much, but we did also, you know, reveal the main announcements. We talked about Yosemite and iOS 8 in quite a bit of detail, but we figured that most of our readers would already know the facts, and we're kind of adding the opinion. And for us, I think the humour did stand out as being particularly bad this year, and it sounds as though quite a few people disagree, but also quite a few people do agree and agreed. I remember on Twitter there was a lot of chat about it as well. But the perhaps the most important thing is we dedicated an entire segment of our podcast to WWDC. We do this every single year, and we don't really give any other company event anywhere near this amount of coverage, and we often get accused of being fanboys as a consequence. And so I think the fact that we gave the airtime to Apple is a kind of bias in itself. Perhaps within that airtime we could have been a bit more balanced, but I don't think this podcast is about purely objective, dry reporting. You know, one of the things that many of our listeners like about it is that there's opinion. It just seems like on this occasion, a few of you disagreed with those opinions. Katie does a lot of reporting on all the other tech companies.
I'm happy to tell you how bad their press conferences are as well.
The final piece of feedback we had was from Spencer Atkins, who was talking about our BioArt ear story. That was the ear that had been made out of the stem cells of one of artist Van Gogh's relatives' stem cells. And he said, "I laughed when Olivia said she had to phonetically spell Yosemite." I was about to say it wrong again.
How do you say it?
Yosemite.
My God.
It's one of those words, actually, that you read when you're little and you just learn it as it looks. And then you hear it said and it blows your mind. The same happened with Penelope Lively.
Yep. Also, until the Harry Potter films came out, I thought it was Hermione.
Exactly.
Oh, okay. My gosh.
But anyway, He said, I laugh when Olivia said she had to phonetically spell Yosemite. This is a classic example of American English breaking its own grammar rules. It should be Yosemite upon first glance, but we Americanized it. I could produce a list of dozens of locations in my home state that are not pronounced the way they should be if grammar rules are followed. However, I found it even more fascinating how residents of the UK pronounce the name of that famous earless artist, Vincent van Gogh. You say Van Gogh. In America, we say Van Gogh.
And the Dutch say it in a completely different way. Like Van Gogh.
Well, they're the ones that are right, surely.
Yeah. But anyway, Spencer said, I'd actually never heard our pronunciation before, and he's 47 years old. He said, where have I been all this time?
Van Gogh.
Well,
Van
now Gogh. You know the difference, but neither of us are right, so I don't know where that leads us.
Gogh sounds more elegant.
But he's from Huntington, West Virginia, but he said it's pronounced Huntington by locals. So hopefully we now
That's
sound
great.
Like... Huntington.
I like Huntington. You, Spencer.
Huntington, West Virginia.
Tell us more.
But we should reinstate our audio messaging system.
Oh, would we get audio feedback?
I would love to hear Spencer say all of these things.
Yeah. In a beautiful Virginia drawl.
Okay, well, if you'd like to deliver feedback over the phone, don't worry, it won't be direct to our landline. It'll be on a kind of recording message service. Do let us know, podcast@wired.co.uk. But I think we have to leave it there. We will be back next week and very much look forward to it. Bye-bye.
Bye.